NREM Breaking News.
Despite limitations in testing, we are seeing significant increases in the number of patients in the U.S. being diagnosed with COVID-19. There's been a lot of chatter that we are simply lagging behind what's been happening in Italy over the last couple of weeks, and that we may see spikes similar to what they've experienced, as well as clinical burdens similar to what they have. If this is true, and even if it isn't, it'd be great to get firsthand information from frontline docs on what's going on in Italy. Simon Carley, who's an EM doc in Manchester, England, and creator of the free open access St. Emlyn's blog and podcast, recently chatted with Roberto Constantini, who is in Milan and has exactly that firsthand experience. The following was published on the St. Emlyn's podcast on Saturday, March 14th, and we asked Simon if we could publish it here as free open access content to get it to as many clinicians as possible. Simon and his team at St. Emlyn's do fantastic work, and we encourage you to pop over to their site and see the show notes that they laid out, as well as the other fantastic content they produce every week. Without further intro, let's get to the cast.
Hello, and welcome to the St. Emlyn's podcast. My name is Simon Carley, and today I am delighted to have a great friend of ours, Roberto Costantini, who is from Northern Italy, who's going to help us understand how we might prepare better for the forthcoming COVID-19 problem that I think we're all going to face. So Roberto, thank you so much for joining us today. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I work in a very big hospital in Bergamo, which actually is a very small town north to Milan, but which serves as a tertiary hospital, an area of more than 1 million people. So we have around 800 beds, and we see almost 100,000 patients per year in our emergency room. Well, the epidemic started in Italy around the 15th, 16th of February. In another town, south Milan, which is called Lodi, where the leader of the emergency department, who is Stefano Paglia, who is a very smart guy, developed a very fine model to face this terrific epidemic. And I had the luck to go there 1 week before the epidemic started in Bergamo to see how he arranged his emergency department. And we adopted his model that I think could be useful for many other people around.
So you're now in the actual epidemic itself. And
yeah.
It must be a tough time. So I wanted to start off really by asking you, how are you getting on and how are your staff feeling and how are you coping at the moment?
Yeah, we started our epidemic smoothly on the 21st of February with the first two cases of pneumonia. And we immediately recognized that it was a COVID infection because it's a very typical pattern in terms of radiology and clinical aspects. I will tell you later about the specific aspects of the pneumonia. And we had the time to prepare because the first phase of the epidemic is typically smooth and with an upper airway presentation, cough, pharyngitis. So we have 3 to 4 days to recognize that it was arriving, because it was the exact same phenomenon as in Lodi, as in the first town where the epidemic started in Italy. And then the second phase was characterized by the presence of fever. And there we have the confirmation that it was a COVID outbreak, because fever is completely different than the usual, the regular fever or the seasonal flu, because it's very long, it's prostrating, and lasts at least 4 to 5 days. And then maybe subsides and then comes again, or it lasts 10 to 12 days. So at that point, we realized we were in. And then at that time, we started to reorganize our emergency department according to the model of Lodi, because we knew that a great number of patients with severe pneumonia will be coming in the next few days. This was what happened on the second week.
So just stop you there a bit, Roberto. So I think for us at the moment, and I think some of our colleagues in the US and Australia, I think we're probably in that early phase. So we're just seeing lots and lots of patients who've come through with the symptoms of the fever and the cough. And we're just starting to see the very severely affected patients who are coming in hypoxic with pneumonia, looking very unwell. And we haven't got many of those at the moment, but are you saying that that's fairly typical, that we'll see a few for a period of time and then it might get worse?
Yes. Initially, there are some sparse cases of pneumonia that increase steadily until they are at least 50% of patients with fever. And then there is a steep increase of pneumonia. Now we see almost 80, 90% of patients with fever who come to emergency department with pneumonia, which is the vast majority.
So as I say, my department's not a dissimilar size to yours. So at the peak of the event, how many patients were you seeing with pneumonia coming through a day?
At the peak, I think 70, 80. Till now, we saw the start of the epidemic around 900 patients with suspected COVID infection. The first 100, 150 were upper airway infection or fever. And during the last 10 days, we saw 400 patients with pneumonia. Last 10 days.
So that's a huge number coming through.
Yes, it's a huge number. But this is not the only thing that is terrific of the epidemic. The other is the characteristics of pneumonia. As you may have seen in your first cases, patients are extremely hypoxic, and despite that, they are not so dyspneic or in respiratory distress. Mm-hmm. They present with a very low puffy ratio, less than 100, and they breathe normally because the lung is very soft at the beginning. And this one point. The other point is that the natural history of pneumonia is typically very long. And this is a huge stress for the health system because you progressively see patients and admit patients to your ward, ICU, and then you know in advance that will stay in the hospital at least 7 to 10 days. So you rapidly finish your bed resources in your hospital.
Just the simple maths there is that if you're admitting, say, 40 patients a day for 10 days, that's 400 patients as inpatients with significant respiratory disease. So that is even a hospital the size of mine.
Yeah.
Again, it's similar to yours. That would be a huge stress on the system.
Yeah, it is. And the stress is not only for the hospital, but also for the entire area, because the math tells you that you have to look for other beds outside your hospital to look for patients during the recovery phase. Otherwise, you don't have empty beds to admit the sickest patients. So it's a matter of organization of the entire health system. We set up a network for ICU beds, HDU beds, high dependency unit beds, and regular beds, war beds, and also recovery beds outside. I think this is crucial to face the epidemic.
Okay. And you told me that you had rearranged the way that the emergency department runs. So at the moment, our emergency department is just as it always has been. But as of next week, we're going to divide our department up into a respiratory department where we will see any cases of the respiratory and an everything else department. So we're going to basically create two emergency departments on our site. Did you do something similar?
Yes, we did so. And now my emergency department, it's a huge, long unit and very small, clean unit to look for other patients. And we divided the long unit into three levels of intensity care: high intensity, intermediate, and low. Because the severity of pneumonia is so high that more than 30% of patients who came to our hospital needed an FiO2 greater than 50%.
Right.
That's incredible.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a stress not only for patients, but also for the doctor, for the nurses, for the entire system, and also for the logistics, because you run the risk to go short of equipment, of oxygen masks, CPAP equipment, and so on. So you have to buy everything in advance.
So what sort of, when these patients are coming in and they're hypoxic, sort of in the intermediate group who are requiring oxygen, what sort of oxygen targets are you heading for? So they're coming in quite with what sort of saturations are they arriving with?
Almost 0.5% comes with a saturation lower than 90% on room air.
Wow. Okay. And you're presumably getting them up to what, 92, 93, 94% with oxygen?
Yes. The target is this one. Yes. 92, 93 or a bit less if they have a chronic lung infection.
Sorry, how many of the patients are requiring intubation in the ED?
In the ED, very few, because we have access to in-hospital beds quite rapidly. So I think we had to intubate patients in the emergency department. I think till now, I think 10 patients, no more. Mm-hmm. And the rate of intubation of admitted patient is about 3-4%. But okay. Most of them need non-invasive ventilation. This is the key point, because this is a very high number of patients. And this is a very high stress for the emergency department and also for the hospital, because you have to arrange a semi-intensive unit, high-intensive unit, very large.
And so presumably those patients are cohorted, because at the moment we're not using a non-invasive ventilation because of the risks to sort of aerosolize around. But I guess if you cohorted them in one area and everybody's wearing PPE, you can still use non-invasive ventilation under those circumstances.
Yes.
And you're saying that my understanding is that the lungs are quite pliable. So these aren't difficult to ventilate people. So they probably don't need a lot of support. They just need a relatively small amount of pressure support, I would guess.
Well, we generally treat this patient with a mere CPAP, one level pressure.
Yeah.
Because the lung is very soft. It's much, much easier than the bi-level ventilation. You don't need a ventilator. The only variable that is crucial is you need a high flow generator. Otherwise, you can't do CPAP. And in general, we use a helmet, much more comfortable than the mask. And also, it's less dangerous than the mask because of the leaks. If the helmet is the right size, you have no leaks at all.
Okay. And so these patients are coming in, you're doing the assessments. Did you think that the number of other patients, so the patients who don't have respiratory or lung problems, you're saying that you think those numbers went down in Italy, so you saw fewer of them?
Yeah, there was a huge, a massive drop of other patients.
Okay, well, that's a good thing, I suppose, because it means that we can move patients and staff from one area to the other. So that's really, really interesting.
The other thing about the clean patient, let's say, the other thing that's interesting that we rearranged at a larger area within our region, which is 10 million people, is to dedicate some hospital to, let's say, stroke, another hospital to STEMI, and so on, in order to optimize the resources and concentrate a COVID patient to some hospital.
Okay, and how have the staff coped with this? Because in England at the moment, there's an awful lot of anxiety and worry and concern amongst the staff about treating these patients. How have your team coped once it actually starts? Because I think everybody's going to be anxious at the beginning.
Yeah.
But once it gets going, how has that been?
Yeah, sure. Well, we were prepared because we've seen what was going on in Lodi, and we wear always the PPE. So the rate of infection of my colleagues here in the medical department is very low. It's less than 10%. It's around 5%. So I think this is not for now a great concern for my team. The great concern is from the side of motion, because it's really hard to see so many people sick at the same time. It's like a regular daily earthquake. In the first hour of the afternoon, in general, the disease in the fever goes up and people get worse. And this is the reason why in our emergency department, we saw this in Lodi and also in Bergamo. We see lots of patients at the same time come to the emergency department with shaken chills and dyspnea. And this is very hard to face. I think that this is one of the most important aspects of coping with COVID. We have to be prepared, not only mentally, but also emotionally.
Okay.
And we ask help for the psychologists of our hospital, because this is tough. And this is to be prepared and programmed in advance.
So you think we should be thinking about that now?
Because otherwise it's too hard.
Okay. And what sort of things?
Sure. And also one of the most important things is to synchronize hospital admission with the inflow of patients in the emergency room. One day we didn't synchronize very well. It was the day of the peak, the 8th of March, where we saw, I think, 80 patients with pneumonia. And we didn't have beds inside the hospital. So we had patients with oxygen everywhere in our emergency room. And this was very, very, very tough. And we reached the top of 105 patients within my emergency room. That was really, really awesome. That was the moment when I called my director and asked him to go there, to go down, because in general, the emergency room is down, to see the patient, because figures, number, talk to the brain, but images talk to the heart.
So there's a lot of stuff in Twitter and on social media at the moment to say that in certain parts of Italy, the number of intensive care beds has not been enough, and they've had to make some difficult decisions about who gets admitted to intensive care units and who might go onto ventilators. Is that something which is just on Twitter, or is that something which has happened in Italy? Maybe not in your place, but in Italy in general?
No. Well, sometimes we work with limited resources. This this may not be true for ICU beds, but maybe for CPAP equipment. This is tough. In Italy, we had already a network of ICU beds for ECMO, which work phenomenally to increase the number of beds to meet the requests of ICU beds for the COVID outbreak. But anyway, we have something like a score to identify patients who likely benefit of intubation and ICU admission, and those who might not. But this is not war. This is regular work.
And I think that happens here as well. We've always made judgments about who is most likely to benefit from intensive care medicine. So it's reassuring to hear that there hasn't been a dramatic change in your locality, and that actually we're still applying the same levels of clinical judgment. And I think that that's a really important message to get out there to people. So that's very positive. Are you doing any other therapies apart from the sort of ventilatory support? So I've read reports of people using things like hydroxychloroquine and some other antiviral drugs.
Yes, we use it. There's no proof that it works, but you use both antivirals and hydroxychloroquine. Yeah. We're running a trial on anti-interleukin 6, but we enrolled a few patients. And also we're running a trial within our emergency department on sildenafil.
Okay.
But we enrolled too few patients.
Because that's a drug which is used, I think, in pulmonary hypertension, isn't it, quite a lot?
We have a lot of data, a lot of patients, and we had no time to study now.
No, that can come later.
That's
definitely something for later.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be some fascinating science that comes out of this, sadly. That's one for definitely for later on. So looking at and listening to your experience, it sounds very much as if we're here in the UK, we need to really think about dividing our departments up and having areas which are dedicated to lung pulmonary disease. We need to train with PPE a lot and now. And we need to expect, it sounds like there's a diurnal variation. So maybe in the afternoons, we can expect to see peaks of admissions, and that we need to be able to potentially provide oxygen support and some CPAP support to quite large numbers of patients at times. That seems to be what you're saying.
Yeah, sure. The other thing that is interesting in terms of change the hospital, the entire hospital organization, is the collaboration between physicians, because we progressively converted beds devoted to other specialties to COVID patients. So from a certain point, we didn't have more doctor dedicated to COVID, let's say ID physicians, pneumologists, intensivists. So we have to enroll other physicians who are not very accustomed to see patients with acute respiratory failure to see this kind of patient. So we had to run a course for them to recognize acute respiratory failure and the alarming signs and to wear the PPE and so on. But this worked very well. We had a very well response. So I think that the entire emergency department, the entire hospital is completely changing. We won't be the same after the outbreak.
When you say other doctors and clinicians, from what other specialties were they coming from?
Well, the first were the surgeons, but then the urologists, the ophthalmologists, the oncologists, the nephrologists, and so on. Almost all all physicians in our hospital.
Well, that's fantastic. It's really good that people have stepped up and agreed to support. And I know that there are plans in the UK to do something similar to when the routine activity goes down.
Yeah.
But what you're saying, and I think I'd agree with you, is those people need a bit of extra training. They need a bit of induction. They need to be brought up to speed so they're comfortable and safe and happy working in the emergency department.
And this work much better if you can do it in advance.
Yes. So maybe think about doing it now.
And if you can tell them that in case you get an outbreak terrific like this, you will do that.
Okay. So that's something that we are thinking about now, but we've not yet done, but we can get onto that and certainly move with it. So we've been talking for some time, Roberto, and I always try and keep these tight because I know you're incredibly busy and I know you've done really great job to come on the call tonight. So I'm incredibly grateful. Is there anything else that you think that you'd like to tell us? I mean, I think we're all a bit scared about what's going to come. And do you have any words for the people who are worried?
I see. Yes, I see. I think we can manage. I think that knowledge sharing and the form also could help us a lot. Because after all, this is emergency medicine.
Yeah.
This is what we studied for. So we are able to do it. So don't panic. We'll get it over.
I think that's such an important message. And it's really heartening to hear that. I'm always, you know, always worried that we'll have a conversation. You'll tell us, you know, it's just awful. But it sounds like you've done an incredible job. You know, you, your colleagues, your hospitals, the other specialties. It sounds like you've done, you know, maybe the pinnacle of emergency medicine to deal with a true ongoing disaster with lots and lots of sick people who really need our help and in whom we can make a difference. And I guess that's why a lot of us went into emergency medicine.
Yeah.
So I guess this is an opportunity.
Yeah, sure.
We wouldn't have chosen it.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have chosen it. But if it's here, we've got to step up.
Yeah, sure. Yes, we'll never be the same.
That is amazing. Thank you so much, Roberto. If it's okay, I'm going to put this out fairly soon into the FOMED world.
Yeah, sure.
I probably won't do that much in the way of editing because I think I just want to hear your voice and I want to hear your experiences. It's been amazing.
Okay, thank you very much, Simon. Good luck.
Okay. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks again to Simon and Roberto for doing this. This is going to be really critical information for all of us to have. Listen to it again. See what steps you can take and what you can do in your emergency department, in your hospital, to start working on this, pushing it forward so that we are ready when the surge comes. We will be back later this week with another breaking news update. We also have a great chapter on Corpendium addressing COVID-19, so check out that as well. And everybody out there, stay safe.